Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 66. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and it's great to have your company. Before we dive into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast and welcome patrons who joined the Talking Tudors family in February. A warm welcome to Jess, Sarah, Tracy, Alyssa, Jenna, and Jasmine. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. March's prize is a copy of Tudor King in All But Name, The Life of Edward Seymour by Margaret Scard. Thank you to the History Press UK for sponsoring this wonderful prize. I'm also excited to share that the author of this month's patron prize, Margaret Scard, is today's guest. Margaret's interest in history developed after she began work as a volunteer guide at Salisbury Cathedral, something she's continued for 25 years. For several years, she did occasional work at Hampton Court Palace as a costumed historical interpreter, which gave Margaret the opportunity to become very familiar with the history of the palace and the life of the people who had lived there. As part of her research, she came across mention of William Paulet, who built Basing House. His career sounded fascinating, yet there was very little detail about his life, so she began to dig deeper, and the project just grew until she'd written a book about him. Margaret's biography of William Paulet was published in 2011, followed by a biography of Edward Seymour, Lord Protector during Edward VI's reign, which will be reissued in paperback format in early March 2020, under a revised title of Tudor King in All But Name. Margaret's primary historical interest is the 16th century nobility and the role of these men in the political and social life of the Tudor court. Her latest research on Elizabeth I and the nobility has been accepted for publication. My conversation with Margaret straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales.
Thank you.
welcome to Talking Tudors, Margaret. Please tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, my first degree was in mathematics. I have to say I was put off history at school by, as a 15-year-old, learning about the First World War and the great reform bills of the 19th century. But quite some years ago, I started guiding at Salisbury Cathedral, and it was really there that my interest in history was galvanised. I started doing a lot of research for working at the cathedral, and I saw some occasional mentions of William Paulet and became increasingly interested in him. And that was really the starting point for my long interest now in history. For a few years, I was lucky enough to work as a historical interpreter in costume at Hampton Court Palace. And that gave me an opportunity to extend my research into Paulet and also to become very familiar with life at the Tudor court.
Well, that sounds wonderful, doing all those amazing things. And I love Hampton Court. That's just such an amazing place. Now, Margaret, let's talk more about William Paulet. You've written an excellent biography on him. You mentioned how you came to first hear about him, but what specifically drew you to his story?
I think it was the fact that he was at court for so long. He had so many roles, and yet there was so little information about him. And I was fascinated by the idea that he could survive at court in such an influential position for so many years. And then despite the changes of monarch, changes of religion, he still managed to die at home of old age at the age of 87. And that was a remarkable achievement at that time.
Absolutely. And we're going to touch on that a little bit more later on. But it, just to begin, just to give our listeners a little bit of information, could you talk to us a little bit about Paulet's early life and his background?
Well, he was born round about 1484 into a gentry family in Hampshire. He spent some time at Oxford University and studied law in London and probably practiced as a barrister for a short time. But in his mid-20s, he was called back to the family home in Basing in Hampshire by his father, who was ill. And for the next few years, Paulet effectively ran the family estate. And then he served as a steward, justice of the peace, and also was steward for the lands of the Bishop of Winchester. So he was quite busy for the next few years. He served both Richard Fox and Thomas Wolsey, and it was probably through the patronage of one of them that Paulet finally made that step from being a local county official to being a government administrator. In 1526, he was appointed to be Master of the King's Wards, which was managing the estates and finances of underage heirs and heiresses. But his big break came in 1532, when he was appointed controller of the royal household. And that was a position which meant that he would live and work in the royal palaces. So that was when he came close to the king. But I think the interesting point is that by this time, he was nearly 50 years old. So he was already, by their standards, he was already an old man when he was first appointed to court.
How interesting. Now, you describe Paulet as kind of the ultimate courtier. So what did the role of the Tudor courtier involve, and why was Paulet so good at it?
I think the role of a courtier was service to the monarch, and that's what Paulet was good at. He worked for the good of the monarchy and the good of the country, and he was part of the machinery of government for 40 years. So I think of him as being the exemplar of a successful courtier, because he held a greater number of different offices. He served more monarchs, survived more changes than any other courtier. And he was efficient, he was organised, trusted, loyal. He was everything you would want in a civil servant. And that's basically what he was. His roles include Master of the Court of Wards, he was Controller and Treasurer of the Household, he was Lord Chamberlain, Lord Great Master, a Privy Councillor. He acted as Lord Privy Seal for a short time and was Lord Treasurer for 20 years. So just by studying this one man, you can examine most of the important offices at court. So that for me is why I think he was the ultimate courtier, because he could do everything that the king asked of him.
And tell us about some of the routines and the rituals that shaped the daily life of Tudor courtiers.
Well, the purpose of the court was to provide a home for the king, and everything at the court revolved around the king, making sure that he was well catered for and that the court displayed his magnificence. So that is what the courtiers were entailed to do at court. So it was quite an early start to the day. Members of the Privy Chamber, for instance, were expected to be ready and dressed so that the king could rise at 7 o'clock each morning. People such as Paulette would have spent quite a lot of their time attending meetings as controller and treasurer. He would have attended the board of green cloth each morning. That was quite an early start, between 8 and 9 o'clock. Sessions of Parliament also began between 8 and 9 o'clock. The Privy Council met on several days a week. And of course, they had to make time between these meetings. They had to make time for their meals. So they'd be dinner in the morning at 10 o'clock and supper in the afternoon at 4 o'clock. At other times, you'd probably find Paulette in the Privy Chamber with other courtiers, waiting in case the king called to talk to him or take his advice. But the court was very hierarchical. So much of what happened there, how close you came to the king, for instance, was determined by your rank. So if you were going to have access to the Great Hall would be relatively easy. But to have access to the presence chamber and the privy chambers, you'd need to be a very high rank. There'd be all sorts of rituals connected with being in particular rooms. If you were in the presence chamber, and the king was not in the chamber at the time, you would still bow towards the empty throne. There was a hierarchy amongst the courtiers. So if two courtiers would meet at court and they were to acknowledge each other with a bow, the one of lower status would have to bow lower than the one of higher status. So there were all these little personal rituals between the courtiers. There were many rituals connected with eating meals. If you were eating in the presence chamber, the table you ate at would be allocated by your rank again. Upon a table, messes of food were served so that there would be bowls of food for four people. A mess would feed four people. And there were lots of, we would call them hygiene rules about how you handled the food, how you used your napkin. So there was a lot of the court that was laid down in the ordinances as to how people should behave.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. I love hearing about those details because obviously some people, you know, perhaps some movies give people the impression that they weren't concerned with those kinds of, you know, etiquette, food etiquette and things like that. But of course, they were. So it's fantastic. I love those details. You obviously mentioned that Paulette served at a number of courts. So he served at the courts of Henry VIII, Edward VI, Mary and Elizabeth. And you've mentioned some of the highlights of his career. Quite an astonishing career, really, spanning 40 years, which is incredible. Are there any kind of other highlights that you want to mention about that long and varied career that he had?
I think two highlights, and they're not necessarily highlights in the sense of being good, Paulette, but I think two highlights would be the two occasions when he put his life at risk by the decisions that he made. And one of those would be when the councillors staged a coup against Edward Seymour, Duke of Somerset. If that had fallen out the other way, and if Somerset had survived, he might well have taken his revenge on the councillors such as Paulette, who turned against him. And similarly, the attempt to put Lady Jane Grey on the throne was another time of danger for Paulette. Although he had very reluctantly agreed to Edward's plan for Jane to succeed him, and he was one of the first people, in fact, to leave Jane's side and to go and support Mary. If Jane had later become queen, Paulette would have been in serious trouble. So I think those are two of the highlights, because his life could have been in danger if things had fallen out differently.
Now, I imagine that some of our listeners, after hearing about, you know, him serving the different monarchs and how long his career spanned, might be wondering how it is that he managed to keep his head in such a tumultuous period of history when so many of the people he worked with, you know, weren't as lucky. And you've talked about some of the qualities that made him a fantastic courtier. Why do you think, though, Margaret, he was able to keep his head in this time?
I think it's because he kept the support of the four monarchs and he didn't make few enemies. Many of the influential people, the famous people at court, were brought down not by the king or the queen, but they were brought down by their enemies. People such as Wolsey, Cromwell, Somerset, Duke of Northumberland. It was often their enemies who were feeding information to the king, and that's why these men were executed. Paulet described himself as a willow, not an oak. And this has often been taken to mean that he swayed with prevailing policies and changed his minds to suit the time. But that's not what he meant. What he meant was that he treated people gently. And so he would effectively, as he put it, he treated them or chastised them with a willow stick rather than with an oak cudgel. And so he was gentle with people, didn't alienate the people who disagreed with him. So I think that's a very important point. He had all the qualities that you would want of a good civil servant. He was honest, loyal, trustworthy. Queen Elizabeth once said that of all the noblemen around her on one occasion, he was the only one who was on her side. And despite knowing that he was probably a Catholic, she kept him as Lord Treasurer. And in fact, there's a lovely little tale that after a very successful royal visit to Basing House, Elizabeth was heard to say that if Paulet had been a young man, she would have taken him to be her husband before any other man in England, which I think is wonderful. But at the time, if my memory serves me correctly, I think Elizabeth was 25 years old and Paulet was 75 years old. So it was unlikely to happen. But I think perhaps best of all, Paulet's own motto of love loyalty and his advice to his children to be loyal to the crown, those best sum up why he survived.
And I'm so glad you clarified about the willow, not an oak, because usually you do hear the story that he kind of swayed and went with what was happening. But I find that so much more interesting that he was gentle and didn't alienate people. I think that makes a lot more sense. So that's really great. Now, Margaret, apart from Tudor Survivor, The Life and Times of William Paulet, you've also written a biography of Edward Seymour, another fascinating person. Why did you become interested in his story?
I think it's because he was the son of a country gentleman. He was just like Paulet. Yet again, he rose to the pinnacle of power. In fact, in his case, he was king in all but name. He was the most powerful man in the country. He had the potential to stay in that position for 9 years and then to continue to be an advisor to the future king. And yet within 3 years, he'd been removed from office. And it was basically because he was self-destructive. And I just found this incredible that a man who had so much potential could ruin his chances by the way that he behaved.
Now, you mentioned that with Paulet, he made, few enemies. But what did Edward Seymour's contemporaries think of him?
Their opinions changed, actually. During Henry VIII's reign, he was praised for his skill on the military battlefield. He was praised for being a general. And interestingly, for the way that he looked after the soldiers and cared about, had concern for the welfare of the soldiers. When Henry VIII died, the Privy Councillors agreed that because Seymour was the new king, Edward VI's uncle, but because of Seymour's great leadership qualities, they thought he should be made Lord Protector of England. Now, this was so that he would be first among equals. He'd be the councillor's representative, but could only take decisions with their agreement. I think the problem was that Seymour was a general. He was used to making decisions, taking the responsibility and giving orders to people, soldiers who obeyed him, but he was a poor political leader. So his style of government effectively sidelines the councillors. And this was really why he had his downfall. The ordinary people loved him. He promised them that he'd make their lives better, and they supported him. But after 2 years in power, Seymour was becoming unpopular with the people that he worked with the councillors. Although they agreed with many of his policies, they disagreed with the way in which he implemented them. So their descriptions of him. So this is only 2 years after taking office. They were describing him as being overbearing, as being arrogant. They accused him of speaking sharply to them being critical. He was critical of people. There are instances where garrison commanders in Scotland were actually fearful of reporting news to him because they were frightened of what he'd say or what he might do. And he was making decisions himself. He was failing to take people's advice. So the councillors ultimately decided that they had to either make him change his policies and the way that he worked, or they had to persuade him to stand down.
Now, I'd love to hear a little bit more about his removal from power. And I imagine that this is quite a complex issue. And I'm just wondering if you, just for the benefit of our listeners, if you could give us a bit of an overview of the sequence of events that led to his removal.
Right, yes. So, as I say, after 2 years in power, the councillors were beginning to lose patience with him. And there were many, many things that they disagreed with. He'd invaded Scotland in 1547 and set up a lot of garrisons to try and control the Scots. Now, this was using an enormous amount of money, which was leaving the country short of money. Seymour had promised the people that he would do various things to try and make their lives better. But the people wanted an instant response. They wanted their lives made better straight away. And of course, this takes time. And the people started to lose patience with Seymour. And ultimately, there were rebellions, major rebellions in the east and the west of the country. And Seymour was forced to send in the army to regain control. Now, the rebellions were in 1549 during the summer. And it was after that that the councillors finally decided they had to do something because Seymour was increasingly isolated from them. In early October, Seymour was suspicious that the councillors were planning to move against him. He was at Hampton Court with the king, and he thought that maybe the councillors were going to come there and stage a coup. In reality, it's probable that all they intended to do was to talk to him and try and persuade him to change the way in which he governed before they had to take any drastic action against him. I think Seymour overreacted, and on Sunday night, at dead of night, he rode with the king and the few courtiers that they had with them. They rode through the night to Windsor Castle, which was going to be, he thought, was going to be easier to defend against any attack. But after a few days, it became apparent that Seymour had, he'd lost the support of all the councillors. And so it was effectively, he was forced to resign as Lord Protector. He was put in the Tower for a time, was released after a few weeks, and eventually was reinstated as a Privy Councillor. But by this time, John Dudley, Duke of Northumberland, had replaced Somerset as head of the council, and the two men were never, ever going to be able to work together. So it was about 2 years later when Northumberland fabricated evidence against Seymour, which ultimately was to send him to the block. So it was a very long period over which Seymour's problems were developing. But I think it's sad because I think he could have been a brilliant king in all but name for a few years. And I think he was just the wrong man in some ways. He was a good soldier, good general, but he couldn't work with his equals. He could only work with the people who were beneath him, I think.
Margaret, in all your years of research, have you ever uncovered anything that took you completely by surprise or made you question a long-held perception that you may have had?
I've thought long and hard about this, and I think perhaps one of the things, the amusing things that surprised me was Tudor bathing. We see images, we see woodcut images of Tudor people in the big communal baths, the stews, having baths together. What fascinated me more was the way that a courtier might bathe at home or in the palace. And I would describe it as dry bathing, where these big tubs were lined with sponges to make it soft, and they would have sheets draped around them so that it was not a rough surface. And then the courtier would sit in the bath, and his servant would have bowls of water, and he would just wash his master with sponges and scented water. And this is so different to what our idea of bathing is like. This is more like a wash, but in a bath. So I think that was one of the things that fascinated me.
Yeah, absolutely. I love all those details about the everyday life because I think they are quite surprising a lot of the time and different to what we might imagine. So that's really great. I know there's some exciting things going on. So can you tell us a little bit about what's next for you and what are some of those exciting things just around the corner?
Well, I think the first big exciting thing is that my last book, Edward Seymour, Lord Protector, that's being republished, but as a paperback in just a couple of weeks' time at the beginning of March. And that will, in fact, be coming out under the title of Tudor King in All But Name. So that's obviously very exciting. But since then, I've moved on, and much of my research now is to do with Elizabeth and the Elizabethan nobility. So really, now I'm covering the whole of the 16th century, looking at the nobility, but that is my focus. It is looking at noblemen's lives, both politically and socially.
Wow. And are you working on a particular book, or is this just kind of general research at the moment?
At the moment, I've been working on a project on the Elizabethan nobility, and I think my idea at the moment is to try and expand this and make it into something much bigger, into a book possibly eventually.
Fantastic. Well, we'll keep an eye out on all those wonderful new things coming your way and our way. That's great. Now, Margaret, at the end, we play what I like to call a little game of 10 to go. So these are just 10 questions just to get to know you a little bit better. So are you ready to do that?
I am.
Excellent. Question one, what was the last film that you watched?
Oh my goodness. A film on Lech Walesa.
And was a favourite childhood book of yours?
I used to love Enid Blyton's adventure stories when I was young. Yes.
Oh, me too. Yes. I love them still. They're wonderful classics. And do you have any writing rituals?
No.
There you go. That was an easy one.
Just peace and quiet, please.
Oh, yes. Me too. Yeah, absolutely. And what music do you like? Do you enjoy listening to?
Mainly classical music. I like orchestral music. I like woodwind music. So I'm particularly English composers, I have to say.
And now you live within reach, I'm sure, of many inspirational places. What's one of your favourites to visit?
Oh, that has to be Hampton Court Palace.
Oh, lucky you. And as a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I was going to be an astronaut. My initial degree in mathematics was also in aeronautical engineering. So my intention had been that I was going to go and work for NASA and perhaps become an astronaut. Obviously, it never happened.
No. And so what changed your mind to follow the writing career?
I think I got married.
Oh, okay. That's all right. And what's your favourite comfort food?
I love chocolate-covered peanuts.
That sounds comforting to me, that's for sure. And what was the last book that you bought, if you can remember? If you're like me, you probably buy a lot.
Well, one of the most recent was on James the First. I'm afraid it's all very history biased, isn't it? Yes, James. Oh,
and if you could spend a day with anyone from the past, doesn't really matter what period of history, who would it be?
I think it would be William Paulet, because I just think he was probably quite a nice man. Interestingly, when I had finished writing the biography of William Paulet, I liked William Paulet. When I finished writing the biography of Edward Seymour, I had a certain admiration for him, but I wasn't sure that I would have liked him.
And lucky last, what's the best or a doesn't have to be the best, just a good piece of advice that you've been given at some point in your life that you wouldn't mind sharing with us?
Well, I suppose particularly in my case, it is if perhaps you don't enjoy a subject at school, don't give up on it. It doesn't mean that later in life you might not come back to that subject from a different direction and then find that you enjoy it.
That's actually really good advice. And I said the last thing, but there's actually one more thing we do, Margaret, on Talking Tudors. We like to end with a Tudor takeaway, which is basically something for our listeners to read or to view or to see or to listen to after the episode that might deepen their knowledge of the Tudor period. So do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
It would have to be a copy of the Chronicle and Political Papers of King Edward VI. King Edward VI was 9 when he came to the throne. He was 15, nearly 16 when he died. But for part of that time, he kept a diary. So this is the diary not only of a child, but also of a Tudor king. It's quite unique, and it records the things that he thought were important, which of course aren't necessarily what an adult king might have thought were important, but it records political events. Some of it's quite routine. The French ambassador came for an audience, things like that. But some of it's much more personal. There's one entry when he just enters that he's just had measles and smallpox. But then there's an entry on another day, and the entries are quite bland. So after the Duke of Somerset has died, and this, you must remember, this is his uncle, he just reports that the Duke of Somerset had his head cut off on Tower Hill. So there's no emotion in it, but it's just a fascinating read of a young king and a young child and what they found interesting in the 16th century.
Well, Margaret, I can tell you that in almost 65 episodes, we've never had that takeaway before. So thank you so much for giving us something new and wonderful to go and lose hours in. That's wonderful.
You're very welcome.
And thank you so much for joining us on Talking Tudors. It's been such a lovely time chatting with you. I've really enjoyed it, and I look forward to hearing more about your books and upcoming projects.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Natalie.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.